It's one of the oldest orders in the Catholic Church. The Order of the Knights of Malta dates back more than 900 years, drawing on a past devoted to the care of pilgrims to the Holy Land. Today, it is a vibrant source of church aid to refugees, victims of disasters, the poor, and those in need of medical care. Emer McCarthy spoke to the Grand Master of the Knights of Malta, Fra Matthew Festing, about the order's history and ministry.
Well, we're here with Fra Matthew Festing, who has the title of the Grand Master of the Sovereign Military Hospital Order of St. John of Jerusalem, of Rhodes, and of Malta, more familiarly known to most of our listeners as the Order of Malta. It's a very long title, but for a very ancient religious order, one of the oldest in the Catholic Church. But can you tell our listeners what exactly all those words together mean?
Well, now, it's a great question, and you're quite right, it's far too long. But, of course, if you've been going for a very long time, in a way, you can sort of collect things together. If we'd all been in one place all the time, then I suppose that we wouldn't have such a complicated name. Equally, you can say somebody like the Benedictines, much older than we are, but they've stuck with one name. It's an accident of history. The sovereignty of the order was given to the order, and not on the basis of, as it were, owning a country. It was given to the order by the Holy Father at the beginning of the 11th century. So that's where that dates from. And then by extension, of course, it was also because they were sovereign, as it were, over Rhodes and then Malta. So that's where that comes from. So that's the first one. Then there's the word military. And military, of course, is a complete mistranslation, because it's nothing to do with being a soldier, it's nothing to do with fighting, it's a translation of the Latin word for a knight. And so the answer is, it comes from miles, it comes from the, as it were, the idea that they were a knightly person. And it's a word that you can't really translate satisfactorily into English. And it's been translated as military, but it isn't really quite what it means. So, where do we go after that? Hospitaller.
Hospitaller
is easy because we have spent our time, 900 years of it, looking after the sick. Again, it's complicated because the word hospitalier, as it were, for instance, in French, means something in French, and hospitaller doesn't mean a great deal in ordinary English. So, again, it's rather a difficult word to translate into English. But it's pretty obvious what it means. It means that we are looking after the poor and the sick, with a particular medical direction in how we do it. So that's how that works. Order then comes from the fact that it's an order of the church, like being any other order. Then we go from there to St. John, and the answer is that we are patronist St. John the Baptist, although scholars will tell you that maybe at the very, very beginning, we might have been dedicated to St. John the Almoner, who was a rather obscure Middle Eastern saint, and much less well-known than St. John the Baptist. But certainly for the last, 850 years, St. John the Baptist has been our patron. Then we go to Jerusalem, because that's where we were founded. That's where the thing, you know, it's where its origins are. Then, of course, when the Latin kingdom of Jerusalem ceased, we then went on a rather roundabout journey from Jerusalem to Acre, Acre to Cyprus, and Cyprus to Rhodes, so that's where the Rhodes bit comes in. And then after the fall of Rhodes, we went to Malta. And then, thank goodness, when we left Malta, they stopped adding more silly things on. Otherwise, we could be from Rome or anywhere else.
But the answer, or Russia.
Well, you know, it's really complicated. But that's why there is this extraordinarily long title. And, of course, it's also why the whole thing is, that's why we're still known as the Knights of St. John or the Knights of Malta, because it's much easier to say so.
You have, of course, a motto. The motto of your order is, do you want to say it?
How do you mean the motto? Do you mean that the two charisms of the order, obsequium pauperum and tuitio fidei, is that what you're saying? Right. Well, obsequium pauperum means that it's the, as it were, the care and the as it were, the looking after, if you like, of the poor and the sick. It's as it were, paupery is obviously is the poor, but by extension, it's also sick people as well. And then tuitio fidei is also very often mistranslated in English because lots of people describe it as the defence of the faith, and it's not what it means. to a degree, of course, it is the defence, but it really, tuitio, is the same word as tuition, and that, of course, means the business of nurturing, encouraging, like tuition, like a tutor with a pupil. A pupil goes to the chap to be taught and to have his knowledge increased. And so again, tuitio fidei means the encouragement, the nurturing, the teaching of the faith. So that's where that comes from.
Of course, we cannot leave out that it was a very important chapter in the history of the order and also a very important chapter in the history of the island. Would you like to take us through that period very briefly, if one can? I know it's very difficult to summarise.
Very, very brief, of course. What happened was that when the order was forced by the Turks to leave Rhodes, and that is a long story in itself, but when they were forced to leave Rhodes, they needed a home. They also had a powerful fleet, and at that stage, although they continued with their hospitaller works, they also were quite a considerable, particularly naval, but also military power. And therefore it suited the Emperor Charles V very well to give them somewhere to go in order to help him defend Western Christendom. And by chance, he gave us the island of Malta. I suppose he might have given us, for the sake of argument, the island of Corsica, say, I don't know, but what happened is that it ended up by being Malta. And that's where that long association from the first part of the 16th century to the very end of the 18th century came from. And so we were in Malta for that whole period of jolly nearly 300 years. I think it's something like 278 years or 280 years, roughly. It's that sort of period of time. So that's where the association of one and the other comes from. Then, of course, it was the longest period that the order actually ruled in a sovereign sense, ruled the territory. So again, it's very, very much part of the history of the island of Malta from that point of view. And then, of course, there were one or two other significant events which took place during that period. The most important one, I suppose, is the siege of Malta in 1565. And so it was really the first time that the advance of the Turks in a westerly direction was definitely halted and they were sent packing. And therefore it was hugely important both for the Maltese people and for the island and indeed for the whole of Western Europe. Otherwise we perhaps would all have remained, I don't know for how long, but certainly when you think about it, the Ottoman Empire continued right up until the First World War. If it hadn't been for the siege of Malta, perhaps we would all have been ruled by the Ottomans until comparatively recently. How does one know? But that's, from that point of view, it's a very important aspect of Maltese history. And, of course, the defence, part of it was carried out, of course, by the Maltese people themselves, but the leadership was provided by the members of the order.
Was that, of course, the siege you're speaking about, was that the siege during which La Valletta, the famous master of the Order of Malta, general, he was one who really orchestrated the defences of Malta, and he's been honoured in Maltese history since. Most importantly, of course, the capital of Malta is named after him.
Of course. I mean, at the time of the siege, the harbour, what we now know as the Great Grand Harbour of Valletta, was, in fact, a natural harbour, which is why, of course, the Turks wanted it and why we were busily defending it. But at that particular time, the central peninsula in the harbour had nothing on it at all. It had a fort at one end, the fort of St. Elmo, which is where a lot of the siege was conducted from and a lot of the fighting took place. But, in fact, the rest of the peninsula was simply bare ground. After the defeat of the Turks, the order then decided that it needed a capital, and because of the importance of the victory, of course, the whole of Europe was quite prepared to, as it were, to support the order and pay for the building of this huge city. And not only just the city itself, but the huge fortifications. And in fact, anybody who knows about fortifications will tell you that the thing that the order built in Valletta, that vast, vast complex of bastions, is really, it's the sort of 16th century equivalent of the atom bomb. If you have it, you're not going to get attacked, and therefore you don't ever have to defend it. If you have the atom bomb, nobody's going to attack you for fear that you might drop it on them. So in a way, it's a rather sort of similar idea, because in fact, until the Second World War, until the Germans and Italians tried to get Malta from the British, those fortifications were never, ever challenged, not once. So that's where, that's the importance in many respects of Valletta. And then, as you say, because the Grand Master was this huge sort of huge hero, obviously within the order and within the island, but indeed for the whole of Europe, that's why the city was named after him. And it's a very odd fact that even, for instance, even Protestant England rang every church bell it could find in the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, in as it were, celebration of the victory. Very odd for a distant Protestant country to do, but that's what did happen.
Now, that is probably one of the high points of the Orders period in Malta, one of the best-known, shall we say, events within the history of the Orders period in Malta. Something that perhaps is less commonly, people are less commonly aware of, is the work that was going on in the hospital that the Order had on Malta, avant-garde medical research, because this, of course, was the main mission also of the Order, was to care, where you took in people to the hospital regardless of their faith, I mean, immigrants and merchants, regardless of their faith, regardless of their culture, their creed. And, of course, you cared for them. This is also another very important aspect of the Order's work, an aspect that's still very important to the Order today. Your involvement with immigrants, your work on the front line of immigration. Here we think, of course, again, of Malta and, of course, of southern Italy, where every summer during the calm period we see wave after wave of boats filled to capacity with people from North Africa, with people from countries that are either going through severe crises of poverty or war. And very few people realise that, once again, it's the Order of Malta who are on the front line, your doctors on the boats. Do you want to speak to us a little bit about that?
Yes, sure. The whole origin, of course, of that is it's nothing new, if you like. I mean, it's what we happen to be doing at the moment. But it's an extension of what we've always done. If you read the very first rule of the Order, which was drawn up by Raymond Dupuy at the very, very beginning, he was the second Grand Master, it doesn't mention a single word about having a navy or an army or bearing arms or carrying a sword. There's not a single word in it. But it says the object of the exercise is to look after the sick. That's what it says in the rule. And it's quite easy to read. It makes it perfectly clear what we should be doing. And that's what we have always done, even while we've been doing other bits and pieces. So both in Jerusalem and at Acre and in Cyprus and in Rhodes and on Malta itself, and indeed ever since, we've always cared for the sick. Now, we've done it in different sorts of ways. Sometimes we've had hospitals. Sometimes we've helped people who have been the victims of war, sometimes the victims of natural disasters, earthquakes, and so forth and so on. Nothing new in that either. And indeed, looking after refugees has been a long... We have a long, long, long tradition of doing that. And so, unsurprisingly, as well as, for instance, being involved in the L'Aquila earthquake, for instance, quite recently in Italy, and in the present earthquake in Haiti, we're very much involved there, we're also very much involved in the business of trying to look after some of these refugees who arrive. And, of course, it's not... I wish it was just... You mentioned North Africa, but, of course, it's a much bigger problem than that, because there are people arriving in the southern coasts of Europe from all over Africa, all over the Middle East, and even from the Far East. And, for instance, not very long ago, I did a visit to Lampedusa, and there seemed to be people from practically every part of the world except North and South America and Europe. So there are people from the whole of Africa, right across Asia, right as far away as China, who are coming into Europe. So what we're doing there is assisting the local, as it were, the Italian authorities, the Italian Coast Guard, and providing the medical cover for these people. And once these people, a lot of them, of course, have been adrift in small boats for days, by the time they're picked up, they're very often in a very bad state. And then, in addition to all that, of course, in due course, a lot of them come up into the middle part of Europe, so we're also busily caring for them in other places too, notably in Germany, notably in Belgium, to a degree also in France. And it's a big, big problem. It's a movement of people. It's a serious challenge for the whole of Europe. And, for instance, you only have to see the various immigrants, not all the immigrants that you see, for instance, here in Rome. They're by no means all from Africa. They're also not from Asia, but an awful lot of them are out of Eastern Europe. So, again, where also we have schemes running in various places which are looking after these people too. So, again, it's partly to do an extension of what we did for pilgrims going to Jerusalem all those centuries ago, partly an extension of that, and it's partly also the business of providing the medical cover for some of these people, because a lot of them arrive. Not very many elderly people arrive, but an awful lot of young people and indeed people with children. So, for instance, some of our medical people on the boats with the Italian Coast Guard have even delivered babies on board. So it is extraordinary. the range of, as it were, medical expertise which is required to look after these people.
Doing a series of interviews on the life of the church in Malta, one thing struck me very deeply when I was speaking to a church historian. When he was speaking about the period during which the Order of Malta was a sovereignty in Malta, he said, one of the greatest marks that the order left on us, not only these fantastic forts and battlements, was they created in us the desire to be a missionary church. They turned us from being an inward-looking island to being an outward-looking island. And in fact, today, pro capita, for within its church members, Malta has one of the most missionary churches in Europe. It sends priests out to the world. The Order of Malta is an international organization. It has gone from being one that was concentrated in the Mediterranean areas, in Jerusalem, Rhodes, Cyprus, Malta, Italy, to being an international organization. Can you just give our listeners some idea of the vast amount of countries that you are in very quickly, and perhaps then speak of one project that you hold particularly dear?
Of course. Well, it's an interesting, what the gentleman in Malta said, of course, is very interesting, because actually it's an aspect of our influence there which I must confess I had never thought of before, but it's certainly, I'm sure it's true. I'm sure it's given Malta, the island of Malta, a sort of international flavour, which I hadn't thought about before. Very interesting thought. And then, again, what you say is perfectly true. We have associations of the order, if you like, branches of the order, perhaps one should say, in 46 countries to begin with. Then we then have representations of one sort and another at ambassadorial level with 104 countries. And that allows us to have a basis from which to operate all over the world. And so at the present minute, we have a huge amount going on in very nearly every country of the world. Certainly every continent we have something going on. And obviously the thing varies from time to time and place to place. And one of the things we try to do is to basically do work which is really divided up, I suppose, into three parts. It's day-to-day work in developed countries. So somewhere like Italy or France or Germany or Britain or wherever it might be in Europe, North America and so on. We have a constant everyday presence which may be looking after drug addicts, it may be looking after old people, whatever it happens to be. Some of it is working in hospitals. Then in addition to that, we then have in a lot of developing countries, Africa in particular perhaps, we then have schemes running where we're looking after people with leprosy, we're dealing with people with TB, which of course is now on the increase again, and general medical and social care in these developing countries. So that's the second aspect of it. Then the third aspect is the business of reacting to disasters. And sometimes they're man-made, sometimes they're war, something like that, or something like, for instance, the Haiti earthquake recently. And so we divide up what we do into those three different areas, if you like. And it's difficult to single them out, really. The Congo, where there is a huge amount to do. There are a whole series of schemes which we have there, and it's a vast country with a huge number of people. And in the sort of highlands of the country, we have a number of what we would perhaps call dispensaries looking after people. Some of them are in such remote areas that it's impossible to get from them to any of the centres of population. So, for instance, either to get there ourselves or indeed to get sick people from there to hospital, we've recently had to build well over 270 kilometres of road ourselves in order to be able to move some of these patients around by truck or jeep. So it's a huge undertaking in some of these places. But, of course, that part of Africa, and there are places, Asia is much the same, there are so many people and the problems are so great that I'm sure we'll be there. We've been going for nearly 1,000 years. I guess we'll be going for another 1,000 years, probably. I'm just dealing with the problems of those countries alone.
And a warm thanks there to the Grand Master of the Knights of Malta, Fra Matthew Festing.